ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome to Dads on the Air for February the 17th, 2009. It's a rather wet, cool day here in Sydney. We'd like to welcome all those people who are joining us from around the world and across Australia via live streaming on the 2GLF website. And don't forget that you can also listen to this show at any time later at www.dadsontheair.net. Now, we've got an interesting show coming up, talking to Corey Elam from the Coalition for Equality and Roger Cruz. Corey is a member of the, as we said, the Coalition for Equality, and we're talking about gay surrogacy, which is quite a controversial issue in Australia. And we're fairly used to these days seeing gay women with children and bringing up children without, you know, a mum and a dad. But the whole idea of two men doing exactly the same thing is much more controversial. So we'll be looking at that whole issue today. First up, we'll just take a look at some general news items. The Women's Aid Service is told to help men. A Women's Domestic Violence Service, this is from the Sunday Telegraph, will hand back $720,000 in state funding after being forced to assist men. The Central Coast Domestic Violence Intervention Response Team was last year ordered by the Department of Community Services to change its core function to include helping male victims of domestic violence. The group had been negotiating with the Department of Corrective Services, but talks broke down last month and the program is being temporarily run by police until another group willing to comply with the orders is found. The move has been criticised by domestic violence experts, of course, who say it is unsafe for the group to help both genders. Well, they're not helping men at all. Even the studies in Australia all show that at least a third of the victims representing themselves to hospitals are male, and there are studies all around the world showing that domestic violence is not the gendered crime that so many advocates would like to make it out to be. And we've done quite a number of programs here on Dads on the Air around this theme. Now, under the scheme, support workers contact victims of domestic violence soon after the crime is committed, helping them through the court process. It was piloted 5 years ago by a group of court advocacy workers, including Patricia Gaunt and Kay Spicer. Ms. Gaunt said staff were devastated at giving up such an effective program. Well, it's only effective because they're funding one side of the argument, and you've only got to sit these days in any court in Australia to see this endless string of men completely unrepresented being persuaded to accept domestic violence orders without admission, which of course means that that then goes on their record as being, while it's not a criminal offence, it goes on their record, which means that they have a lot of trouble getting jobs in security and other areas. What do you think, Greg?
Well, I think this is a really clear example of how, unfortunately, feminist ideology gets in the way of everything. These women are prepared to stop helping female victims of domestic violence. There's like 30 women a month going through this program. They're happy to give the money back and not even help those women just to keep their feminist dogma pure. If they were serious about actually helping victims of domestic violence, they would keep this money and they would develop resources to help men. They don't care about victims of violence. All they care about is their belief that we're in a patriarchy and that men are oppressors. This is the most clear example of that, and I'm amazed this story hasn't had more traction and circulation in the media.
Right. Other stories?
Yes, well, there's one here in the Telegraph this morning, a bit of a sad case, really. A boy who fractured his skull, writes Kim Arlington, allegedly when falling from an unsafe bunk bed at a mate's house, is suing his friend's parents for negligence. Cameron Thomas claims he developed behavioural problems after suffering a brain injury at his friend Joel Shaw's place in Bulambi Heights near Tweed Heads in April 2004. The Supreme Court heard the 10-year-old fell when climbing down from the top bunk, which had no ladder or guardrail, in breach of national safety standards. Joel's parents, William and Susan Shaw, are defending the case, claiming Cameron was trying to jump from a chest of drawers when he fell. The court heard that before the accident, Cameron was a happy, gregarious boy who did well at school, had a large group of friends, loved sports and played the piano and clarinet. Afterwards, he suffered from mood swings and became aggressive and withdrawn. Now, the Daily Telegraph has an editorial comment on this particular action here. The reason you sometimes see absurd warning labels on ordinary household objects, caution, glue may adhere to fingers and other body parts, is because someone in the US once sued over it. Now we have a case in Sydney which is comparable in certain ways to US examples. A couple sued, blah blah, we heard all that. This is clearly many times more serious than a slight burn from a clumsily handled coffee mug, but consider the potential effects of substantial damages are awarded. Childhood accidents are inevitable. Ask your friends or co-workers to list their own catalogue of childhood injuries, particularly those who suffered away from home, and you are guaranteed to have quite a list. Now imagine the results if all of those injuries had resulted in lawsuits and court appearances. This is a path down which we do not need to go, and I completely agree with that.
Absolutely.
That editorial. We should keep this stuff out of court. Exactly what they say. Kids have accidents. That's just part of childhood, especially boys. They're actually designed to get injured, and it's actually good for them.
It's good for them, absolutely. How else are children supposed to learn how to interact with their world and what's safe and what not without falling over a few times and learning, okay, I'm going to look out next time and I won't fall the next time?
Oh, yeah, but if you can have a multi-million-dollar lawsuit and get, you know, a good thwack of money for it, then obviously that changes. Well, hey, maybe I could just fall off this bunk bed and fracture my skull and you know, I'll be sweet until I leave school.
And then you get all this situation like in the US where all the busters are plastered with posters of lawyers saying, you know, we'll milk all the money out of your compo case for you and you can exploit the system, and, you know, it just becomes crazy.
Oh, I know.
And once again, the lawyers win.
The Telegraph ran a great series which was headlined The Death of Fun, and they had a whole string of front page stories on this, including, you know, empty parks. There's so many parks in Sydney now where the kids can't go because of all the occupational health and safety reasons at all the insurance companies. So it really does have a dreadful impact on everything. I forgot to introduce everybody. I'm terribly sorry. We've got Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, John. Good morning, listeners.
Our researcher, Greg Anderson.
Good morning.
And myself, John Stapleton. So welcome to Dad's on the Air. There's another story here which is, in my mind, the most brilliantly written and most brilliantly argued piece that's been in the Australian media for quite some time.
This is Nicholas Rothwell writing in The Australian on February 13th. The piece is titled Sorry State of Affairs, and it's about the apology to the Aboriginal Stolen Generations by the relatively new Labor government here in Australia. Nicholas writes, "The first anniversary of the national apology to the Aboriginal Stolen Generations falls today, shadowed by financial turmoil and the heavy pall of bushfire smoke. It is shadowed, too, by promises unmet, commitments fading and fine words receding into the murk of time. When Prime Minister Kevin Rudd delivered his bold, thrice-repeated sorry in federal parliament, he went beyond a mere acceptance of responsibility for past wrongs on behalf of the nation at large. He also gave a pledge to improve Indigenous life expectancy, educational achievement and economic opportunity. A special commission would be set up, the equivalent of a war cabinet, its first task to solve the most urgent problem confronting Indigenous Australia and deliver good housing for Aboriginal people on remote communities. The deeper meaning of Rudd's promise that day was plain. He was accepting the broad argument of the coalition government that the Indigenous world was in crisis and that, in addition to his symbol-rich apology, practical steps were needed right away. The new Prime Minister was taking on that burden. He would discharge it in the light of his own social democratic principles, but the campaign to raise life standards in the bush would continue and even intensify. A year on, things have not played out that way. The reasons for the breakdown in the reform agenda for Aboriginal Australia are multiple, but at their heart lie basic failures by Rudd and his ministers, failures both of sympathy and of analytic understanding. It makes for a sorry and instructive tale. Indeed, the apology itself has had a peculiar psychological effect on the nation. It was given to stave off outrage and protest and to reduce the emotional climate. It has done this all too well. Indigenous campaigners still feel the warm afterglow from Rudd's speech and that hard-won day of concord in the national capital. Their demands are subtly muted now. Their rhetoric is low, and the apology has affected the political landscape and public discourse too. In the wake of such a transformative event, such a lightning flash of clarity, what need for continuing moral fervour over Aboriginal affairs? Haven't we said sorry and made the crucial step? So Nicholas goes on to say, one need look no further than the composition of Rudd's proposed stimulus package, $42 billion, money being spent precisely for the sake of the spending, including $6.6 billion for new houses. Just a year and a half ago, the only national emergency that required vast, immediate expenditure was located in remote Aboriginal Australia. The rhetoric of disaster flared, and $1 billion was pledged by former Prime Minister John Howard as a first down payment, with full bipartisan support from Rudd. The need for spending in the Indigenous realm remains as great as ever. The need for boarding schools, dedicated regional rehabs, all-weather sealed road networks, machine shops for communities, permanent staff accommodation, all the basic infrastructure so gravely neglected for decades. So Rudd, on his stimulus day, very pointedly passed by these public spending priorities and instead tossed the Northern Territory a mere $200 million for its infrastructure projects, a golden chance to spark a renaissance in remote Aboriginal Australia, and at the same time ignite deep-reaching regional development through targeted investment, has been missed.
I thought that was an absolutely wonderful piece. It was published last Friday in The Australian, and well worth looking up. You could find it on the web as well. Nicholas Rothwell, who's an absolutely beautiful writer. We'll be back in a moment, and we'll be talking with Corey Irlam from the Coalition for Equality. we're talking with Corey Erlan. He's from the Coalition for Equality. Welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thanks a lot, guys. Welcome. Glad to be here.
Look, it was all a bit of a surprise. It was unusual, I guess, that there was front page stories just recently on a couple of blokes who are adopting a kid from India, and we haven't seen much of this in Australia, have we?
No, look, I think surrogacy is a relatively new thing, whether it be for gay people or whether it be for heterosexual people. And the interesting bit about the article from India was that they were talking about the fact that it's not really going over to India and discriminating against women and exploiting the underprivileged. It's actually the middle class women in India looking for a better life.
And so obviously this is part of the controversy, isn't it, that people think, oh, we don't want to be exploiting, you know, women in the third world and you know, we want to make sure that this is all above board and no one's being exploited. And you feel that that's certainly the case with the surrogacy services in India, that the women who are doing it of their free will, they're making good money and all of that?
That's the reports that's coming out of India. I personally haven't been there. Of course. I can't comment personally.
So all of this seems to have come out of there was some changes to the New South Wales legislation last year with the Miscellaneous Acts Amendment Same-Sex Relationships Bill, which really went a long way. It went through a whole lot of state laws and brought them all into line in terms of trying to make all parents, whether they're de facto, whether they're married, whether they're gay, whether they're straight, having equality under the law. But that law didn't, it actually only talked about lesbian mums, but didn't actually talk about gay dads who had raised children through surrogacy. And I think probably that's led to this new surrogacy laws, proposed new surrogacy laws by the federal government. Do you want to talk a little bit about these new laws that are being proposed?
Yeah, so there's a committee called the Standing Committee of Attorneys General, which is a panel of all the Attorney Generals at a state level from New Zealand and at the federal level. And that committee is doing a consultation into the issue of surrogacy. Now, probably important for people to understand that surrogacy is a state law issue, and so therefore each of the states are slightly different. What they're suggesting here is that there should be national harmonisation, so that there's the same sort of law across the board. And they've done this sort of thing on evidence amendments, so how people give evidence in court at each state level. They've done similar things in regards to parenting presumptions, which is where somebody's deemed to be a parent. So currently under the law, in some states, it was the case that the male partner of a birth mother is deemed to be the legal parent. What's happened in New South Wales and also recently in Victoria is that it's allowed for the female partner of the birth mother to be deemed to be their parent as well. So where a lesbian couple goes into an arrangement to have a child through perhaps artificial reproductive technology or IVF, the child is then born, and the parent who gives birth to the child has always been seen as the legal parent. Mm-hmm. But the mother, or the non-biological mother, the birth mother's partner, hasn't been seen as the legal parent. These laws are now updated to allow for that person to be protected and for the best interest of the child to be defended, so that they have two legal parents rather than only one.
But there's been a bit of a hole in the case of gay men who may raise a child through surrogacy in that they haven't been named the legal parents, is that right?
Yeah, so it's slightly different for surrogacy because the presumption is linked to the birth mother and that they are automatically seen to be the parent, and there's that biological link. When it comes to gay dads, let's say one dad turns around and donates sperm and they go through an IVF process, what would traditionally occur would be that the birth mother and the biological father would be seen as the parent. What's being looked at, what's been passed in Victoria, and what's being looked at as part of this national harmonisation of surrogacy laws, is that the intending parents, the parents who wish to have the child, and the surrogate parents. So if we look at those two terminologies, the intending parents would become the parent after a period of time, and the surrogate parent would relinquish their parenting rights if they choose to do so.
Okay. This raises the tricky issue of there was actually an article in the paper just a couple of weeks ago alleging that the Australian government was demanding child support payments from a New Zealand woman who'd had a baby for two gay Queensland men. Do you think, is this one of the issues that they're trying to straighten out with this law, these complications where birth mothers may relinquish their rights but then be caught on the hook for child support in some sort of legal anomaly?
Yeah, and what's happening there is that the birth mother can't relinquish her rights unless there's an adoption process or that there's recognition of surrogacy. And the gentleman who engaged in surrogacy with that New Zealand mother are from Queensland, and there's no surrogacy laws in Queensland that cover that scenario. So what happens is the law turns around and says, well, the birth mother's the mother of the child, the biological father's the father of the child, and we don't really recognise the other intended father. So therefore, because the father is looking after the child, the birth mother has to pay child support. Now, that's just outrageous for the fact that the mother has entered into an arrangement where she's providing surrogacy services to the two intended parents, to then have the government come back and say, oh, we're going to charge you child support for doing so. It's just an anomaly that needs to be looked at and resolved.
Well, of course, there's a lot of sperm donors have been caught up in very similar situations where they've donated sperm to often lesbian friends and then been chased for child support later. Surely that should be rectified as well.
Yeah, and that's what's part of the New South Wales and Victorian recent updates were addressing, to ensure that the sperm donor wasn't seen to be the father of the child.
And you think, but that, once again, these are state issues, so that's now been clarified in two states, but apparently in South Australia or WA, some of the other states, do you think that still may be a problem because we don't have uniformity around those law reforms? Is that right?
Yeah, WA allows for that sort of thing. South Australia doesn't cover it off in a holistic way, nor does Queensland. So part of this process that the SCAG or the Standing Committee of Attorneys General is going through is actually to try and harmonise all of those things into sync.
One thing I don't understand is why it is a state and not a federal issue. The Family Court, for example, is a federal court. Why exactly is it a state issue?
Yeah, well, the Family Court actually is a federal court based on a referral of powers from the state. So in all states other than WA, rather than having their own family court like WA does have, they've turned around and said it's simpler and easier and logical for us to give this responsibility to the federal court, to the federal system, and that will be processed through the family court.
So the states would now have to turn around and do the same thing over the surrogacy issue, is that right?
That's one option that they could look at. Probably what's more likely is for this SCAG process to create a template bill, if you like, or a model bill, and for each of the state parliaments to pass that bill.
We're talking with Corey Erlam. He's from the Coalition for Equality. We'll be back in a moment.
She sang all the time. Her the way.
In distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back talking with Corey Erlam. He's from the Coalition for Equality. Welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, guys.
Now, how big an issue is this for gay blokes across the country?
Yeah, look, it's hard to actually track down formal numbers because the Australian Census doesn't specifically cater for it. But they did do a drill down into the data last census in 2006, and there was 26,500 same-sex couples, of which 6,500 had children. Now, I don't have the breakdowns in front of me between female lesbian mothers and gay dad parents, but it's somewhere around that order.
One would assume that the majority of that would be lesbian mums, wouldn't it? We're much more used to the idea of lesbian mums these days than we are of gay dad mums, aren't we? The gay dad dads.
Well, there aren't any lesbian fathers, put it that way.
Oh,
well, sometimes I wonder.
Yes. But it is traditionally been the case, hasn't it, that the majority of gay parents have ended up being lesbian mums, almost sort of by default because of biology. It's sort of easier to get some sperm than to get a surrogate to raise your kids, obviously.
Yeah, look, I think that's definitely the public perception. As I said, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I know personally of 12 parents who are gay dads. And I'm sure that there's a lot more out there. I think that it's, as you said, society handles the fact that two mothers want to have children a lot easier because of the perception that having children's a woman's thing and that it's maternal. But as many of your listeners will relate to, there's an underlying desire in men also to have children.
Well, that's very true, and I think a lot of gay blokes, if you talk to them, will say that they would really love to have children. What about the whole thing? Certainly some of our listeners would be fairly outraged by even the concept of a gay dad. They'll say there's no such thing, basically, and that this is all an assault on the traditional family and an assault on the basis of civilization. And what do you say to those sorts of arguments?
Well, look, let's first talk about the pink elephant in the room. In 1973, Anita Bryant closely linked the concept of pedophilia with gay men. And that sort of perception that all men are pedophiles if they're gay and that they're just after children has been around as part of our society for a number of years. And I think that's the first hurdle for any gay dad looking to have children, because society goes, well, you know, you're not a fit parent. That's completely false. The majority of children who are abused often happen from a heterosexual standpoint to somebody that they know as a family member. Research out there supports that. But then, you know, overcoming that issue and somebody recognises that a father's just as equally, whether they're gay or straight, the next concept is, well, what about the mother's influence, the maternal nurturing? Look, research shows that it's not about having a mother and a father, it's about having love of parents. It's about having somebody who supports them. And I'm sure many of your listeners out there may be in a situation where they don't have a mother permanently involved, or whether they have the father permanently involved, unfortunately. And those children grow up healthy and have fun. The bonus here is that those children in a gay dad's relationship or a lesbian mum's relationship, to use those terms, has the advantage of having two parents. And two parents who have jumped through a number of hoops and gone through quite a lot of hurdles to actually have those children. Those children are to be loved, and ultimately it's love that makes that family and actually allows that child to grow up in a safe and loving environment.
Well, of course, not everyone will agree with you, and some people would argue that they really need a male role model and a female role model, and that is the healthiest way that a child can grow up. What do you say to that?
Look, I think just about every gay dad's or lesbian mum's environment has that role model around them. They have close friends, they have uncles, they have grandfathers that are there to help shape that role model influence, if you like. But the need to have a mother and a father, I think, is an antiquated view based on a nuclear family where you have a mum and dad and 2.3 kids. The reality of today's society is that we have many blended families. We have single parents, we have gay parents, we have straight parents who are in an abusive relationship who abuse their child but still are seen to be the nuclear model. It doesn't necessarily work in all scenarios.
Do you think many gay parents, I guess male and female, worry about, because there's still a lot of stigma attached to being a gay couple in Australia, unfortunately, even in 2009, that their children, when their children go through school and they say, you know, I've got two mummies or two daddies, that the kid maybe suffer some, you know, some taunts or teasing or bullying because of that? Do you think that's a worry for gay parents?
I think it's a worry for any parent that their child's going to suffer bullying
or teasing,
whether it be because they have two same-sex parents or whether it be because they're fat or because they're a nerd or because they're into soccer rather than Australian rules or because they're into cricket rather than tennis or anything. It's a common worry across all parents, I think.
What about the issue there? You talk to a lot of people who say that these boys growing up in lesbian, you know, with a couple of lesbian mums, and because there are so few men in the teaching in the school system, that they're basically surrounded by women, and they don't have any male role models. And even though when the whole enterprise is started, that people will say they want men involved and want male role models, it doesn't actually eventuate.
Look, I haven't seen anything that shows that doesn't eventuate. But again, I would equate it back to a single mother raising a child. My sister is a single mother. She has, I can count, six male role models, including myself, for my nephew, between my stepfather, my father, my grandfather, my other grandfather, and my uncle. And Christian's a wonderful, happy, healthy child.
Yeah, but surely the statistics...
Would anybody say that child shouldn't be raised because it's a single mother situation?
But the statistics do show that a child in a single mother household is disadvantaged in terms of being more likely to end up in jail, in terms of less likely to go on to tertiary education, In terms of more likely to become a substance abuser, etc., etc., etc. I mean, can you honestly really say that not having a mother and a father, a man and a woman as your primary role model, does not affect a child, the development of a child's psyche?
Yeah, for every piece of research that I've been shown that says a child needs a mother and a father, there's an alternate piece of research that says children grow up happily and that it's the discrimination that they face, not the actual makeup of their parental unit, that actually causes half those problems. So what that's talking about is the fact that in the schoolyard they're bullied, where's your dad? Why haven't you got a dad, as opposed to the fact that they've got a single mum. And that's a very big difference, and it's something that you're not going to be able to effectively change because of the fact that there's not a father involved in the situation or there's not a mother involved in the situation. I personally believe that it's love that makes a family, that it's in the best interest of the child to have the protection and rights to access of legal parents, both parents rather than just their biological parent. But again, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I would just caution people to look at multiple studies.
Sure, but there is, well, we're looking at multiple studies. There is evidence, for example, with girls that girls brought up without a father as a role model tend to reach puberty earlier, tend to have more of a tendency to become pregnant, during their teenage years, and have a lot more problems around their sexuality. I mean, these are the results of tests which show that, you know, that not having a father, a male role model, a primary male role model, does actually have a biological effect on the development of young women.
Again, I come back to the point that there are those studies out there and there are the studies that contradict them. There has not been a clear study that definitively proves one way or the other. It comes back to a basis of a range of factors that influence those studies, not just the makeup of their parents, the environment they're in, whether they've got support of other people influencing or not. And no study that I've seen actually comprehensively looks at all of those social factors rather than just the makeup of the parents.
And as you were saying, Corey, a child's, it's obviously going to be a lot better off having two parents rather than one regardless. So I think a lot of studies may be based around single parent families, but I imagine you would argue that with the gay parents, then the child's got two parents. They're a lot better off than being raised by a single parent anyway. Not diminishing the good work done by single parents, but obviously any child with two parents, whether it's a mum and dad or two mums or two dads, is going to have, I guess, twice the love and twice the support. Would you agree with that? Or?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing there, I think every parent could relate to the need for time out and time to just spend time with themselves, and the ability to do that when you have another parent in that unit to be able to take them out for the day and give you your time is a wonderful thing. That's not diminishing that children are loved any less by their parents, whether it be gay or straight. It's just a reality that people need balance. So having that double income, that double love, that double time, energy, effort, that child's going to be happier.
We're talking with Corey Erlam. He's from the Coalition for Equality. We're going to take a quick break now and then come back and finish up with him. And then we'll be talking with Rodney Cruz. He's from Gay Dads Australia. So we will be back in a moment.
Walk. torture chamber disguised as a door, processing daily and an endless onslaught of pain and dysfunction, of lies and deceit, while lawyers circle round like spaniels on heat. Nobody knows how far they can fall till they have been to the seventh floor.
We're talking with Corey Erlam from the Coalition for Equality, talking about the often controversial issue of gay surrogacy. Now, you seem to think that you weren't very sure on the actual numbers, but can we expect that you know, we've all become fairly used to, particularly in places like Sydney, of gay men being around, and, you know, basically you can't be homophobic in Sydney, there'd be no one left to talk to. So do you expect that a lot of these gay men will adopt or will go into surrogacy arrangements?
Yeah, look, adoption's a completely separate topic for another time. A lot of gay men can't adopt at the moment, which presents a raft of problems, particularly in a surrogacy arrangement, because the non-biological parent can only receive a parenting order from the court, can't actually be recognised as the legal parent without what's called known adoption or second parent adoption. But will there be an increase in the number of people who adopt? I think that the obvious answer there is most likely, and purely for the reason that the laws will allow for it a lot easier, and it will make it make their child's rights protected a lot easier without this doubt hanging over them as to what would happen to the child in the event of anything happening to one of the parents.
And do you expect thousands of gay couples to take up this surrogacy option? Is that likely to happen?
Oh, look, all I have in front of me is that there's 26,000 couples registered on the ABS data. Now, we know that that's an underrepresentation of society because of the way that the census was written out. But without a definitive answer as to how many people there are out there that identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, it would be difficult to be able to estimate whether we'll reach into the thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or only hundreds.
Does this legislation contain prescriptions on, say, the age of the parents or on their financial background? Do they need to go through any checks or any of this sort of thing?
Look, the Victorian legislation requires people to undergo both counselling and a police background check to ensure that there's nothing in their history that's against the best interests of the child.
Sorry, is this the surrogate parent or the adoptive, you know, the gay...
This is all parents involved in the process.
All of them, all three, I suppose.
Yeah, that's my understanding on it.
Yep.
And that's part of the process for them to understand what does it mean. The New South Wales legislation, well, it's sort of the New South Wales regulations as opposed to legislation, requires them to go through counselling to understand and ensure they're aware of the social impact, the cultural impact, the religious impact of bringing a child into the world in this way. So there's a lot of protection in there, and it's all around the basis of what's in the best interest for the child.
And what about the issue of payment for surrogacy? With these new laws, will payment be allowed? Will there be limits on payment? How is that all being worked out?
Okay. So there's two types of surrogacy broadly. There's what's called altruistic surrogacy and there's commercial surrogacy. Commercial surrogacy in Australia is illegal in all states. So that's where somebody enters into a financial arrangement with a strange person, a person they don't know, and says, yep, we'll give you $80,000 for you to turn around and create this child for us. That's illegal in Australia and not allowed. What is allowed in Australia is altruistic surrogacy, which is where somebody that you know offers to be the surrogate mother for you and engages in that process. They're allowed to have costs recovered from doing that, so some money for the time that they're off work, their medical expenses are paid by the intended parents or the commissioning parents, depending on what language you use, but there's not a gratuitous payment for doing it, so to speak.
Would you support the legalisation of commercial surrogacy in Australia?
Look, I think that there's a whole raft of issues that need to be worked through before Australia goes anywhere near commercial surrogacy, around ensuring that women's rights are protected, that there is an abusive process, that it doesn't become women walking in feeling that this is the only way that they can survive by doing this. I don't think Australia's at that point just yet.
But then why should all these blokes be trotting off to the third world to do more or less the same thing if they're not prepared to do it here?
Well, it's not so much an issue as to whether the intended parents are ready to do that. It's an issue as to whether society has thought through the ramifications of doing it. Australia, to a large extent, lives an environment unto itself. It's very multicultural. It has diverse range of religions. It's not necessarily a process where people have got to the point of Australia that they're accepting altruistic surrogacy or children born through artificial reproductive technology. Until that point comes along, I don't think that anybody in Australia, any parliamentarian, will be considering to talk about commercial surrogacy.
So are there any other issues that you think the public should be aware of around this issue before we move on to talk to Rodney Cruz from Gay Dads Australia?
Rodney can explore this from a personal standpoint as a gay dad himself, but I guess from a listener's perspective out there being a little bit outraged, why did gay dads have children? Think of it in two parts. The first part is think about the children that have already been born that previously, before this reform came into place, didn't have the legal protection of both parents, that one of their parents weren't able to do simple things like sign a medical record or pick them up from school or give authorization for an emergency procedure to occur in a hospital. Think about the rights of that child and the disadvantage that child faces by not being able to have those two parents' influence in their life. The second part of it is the basic human right for the child to be born is the best way. So when a child is born and an individual has that right to have a child, the best environment for them to be growing up in is with those two parents. So providing surrogacy laws and protections that balance the needs of the commissioning parents, the surrogate parents, and the best interests of the child as the rule, it's necessary to consider gay parents in that process and to ensure that children headed by same-sex parents are protected equally like their heterosexual parent counterparts.
But surely the best way for a child to be brought into the world is in the standard, you know, mother and father 2.3 model child family. I mean, if you're talking optimums, that is the optimum way for it to be.
Oh, look, I knew this was going to come up again, so in the break I took and did a bit of research and the Victorian Law Reform Commission's paper, and their paper in 2004, conducted by an expert in the area, Bruce McNair, turned around and said that do children raised in rainbow families or same-sex families turn out the same as children raised in heterosexual parented families? And
The Australian and overseas research simply answers yes. There's no difference in school performance or IQ. There's no differences in emotional function, psychological or behavioural development, and they do not have gender identity problems or tend to play gender-typical games, and they're no more likely to become gay or lesbian themselves. Again, I come back to my point. For every study that says one thing, there's another study out there, and they need to look at the holistic view out there.
And for those who say that this is an attack on the core, the fundamental unit of civilization, the nuclear family, what do you say to those people?
Thank you for your opinion. I don't agree.
We've been talking with Corey Erlam. He's from the Coalition for Equality. Thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. That was a really fascinating interview. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
I wanna be rich and I want lots of money. I don't care about clever, I don't care about funny. I want loads of clothes and I want loads of diamonds. I heard people die while they're trying to find them. And I'll take my clothes off and it will be shameless, 'cause everyone knows that's how you get famous. I'll look at the sun and I'll look in the mirror. I'm on the right track, yeah, I'm on to a winner. Less about mothers, it's all about fast cars and cussing each other. But it doesn't matter, 'cause I'm packing plastic, and that's what makes my life so, so, so fantastic. And I am a weapon of massive consumption, and it's not my fault, it's how I'm programmed to function. I look at the sun and I look in the mirror. I'm on the right track, yeah, we're on to a winner.
In distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back. We're talking with Rodney Cruz. He's from Gay Dads Australia, and he and his partner actually adopted a kid via surrogacy, and that's the whole issue that we're talking about today. Welcome to Dads on the Air.
Great, it's good to be here.
No, thank you very much for coming on the show. Now, well, let's start at the beginning. How did it happen for you? You and your partner, I understand, what's the term? You adopted a child through the surrogacy? What's the
term is, or the phrase is used, is that we had a child through surrogacy.
Yeah.
My partner and I, Jeff, have been together for about 9 years.
Yeah.
And about 4 years ago, we decided that we'd always wanted to be dads, and we wanted to be full-time dads. And we discovered that we could have a child via commercial surrogacy, which Corey spoke about before, which is illegal in Australia. So we had to go over to the US, where we met a wonderful woman called Kelly, who carried our child for us. And Ethan is now 2 years old.
And is the sperm from one of you?
Yeah, the sperm's from one of us, and the egg was from an egg donor.
Oh, right, so she didn't have any biological connection to the child at all?
No biological connection to the child. She was what's called a gestational surrogate, but she has a strong emotional connection to our family now. In fact, she's become part of our family, our extended family.
She's sort of like an aunt or something to the kid?
Yeah, her family, we call her Aunt Kelly, and her and her family are all very much part of our extended family.
And is it a boy or a girl, your child?
It's a boy.
Yeah. And so how is it all going? I mean, I guess the most obvious thing is that most people perceive gay couples as being inherently unstable, that they don't last. It may or may not be true, but they see, you know, gay men as being somewhat unstable in their coupling.
Yeah, that is a perception that a lot of people in the community have. But I'd say that the instability in relationships is irrespective of whether they're gay or straight. There are, you know, as we all know, there are a large number of heterosexual relationships that break down for whatever reason.
50% these days, yeah.
And gay relationships are no different. But equally, there are many, many heterosexual relationships and gay relationships that last for many years, decades, for a lifetime. That's certainly our plan.
Do you think that the process of having a child and having a sort of common interest in creating a home for someone else actually strengthens the stability of your own relationship?
Oh, yes, it strengthens. It can also be challenging to a relationship, as anybody with children knows. But it's an amazing experience becoming a father and having a life to help shape and mould and guide. It's been a wonderful thing for our relationship, and I'd say, yes, it has strengthened it.
And do one of you, no offence, but do one of you see yourself as the dad and one as the mum, or you're both the dads? How does it actually work?
We see ourselves both as dads.
Does he call you both dad?
He calls us both dad at the moment because he's only two.
Yeah.
But he's starting to call us Daddy Rodney and Daddy Jeff. Some gay fathers adopt a different arrangement, whereas one is dad and the other is papa. But we've elected to go with Daddy Rodney and Daddy Jeff, which is pretty common in Australia for gay dads to do it that way. But we don't see each other, either of us, in any sort of traditional roles, if you like, a mother or a father. We're just two dads raising a child.
And Rodney, have you and Jeff discussed, I guess, the conversation you may have if Ethan, when he grows up a bit more, you know, comes home and says, you know, well, I got two dads and, you know, so-and-so's got a dad and a mum and who's my mum? Have you thought through that conversation that you may have to have?
Oh, yeah, very much so. It's something that all gay dads who go through this process of having children through surrogacy spend a lot of time thinking about. And the way we're approaching it is that we've created a picture storybook for Ethan, for when he gets a bit older, to start asking these questions. And it shows all the people that came together to help create him and bring him into this world. So it's pictures of me and Jeff and our surrogate and their family, our parents, our brothers and sisters, etc. They're all there and they all have had a different role in helping Ethan be born. And Ethan will be shown that story. And as he gets older and able to understand, you know, the concepts in the greater detail, we will happily tell him the reality of the IVF, the surrogacy, how it all worked, and why we did it.
Makes a bit of a difference to the normal birds and the bees routine that most parents go through.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is something that gay dads can't avoid, of course, because there is no mother in the picture. So we do have to think about very carefully how we tell our child that they were conceived via IVF and surrogacy. Straight couples haven't always traditionally done that because they can hide behind the male-female model. And so that can become problematic when children get to those formative teenage years and start questioning, where did I come from? And if they find out that they were an IVF child or a surrogate child, that can be quite distressing at that stage. But that's something that our children won't be finding out at teenage years. They'll be finding out as soon as they're ready to start asking those questions. And that'll be, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of age. And it'll just develop from there.
And Rodney, may I ask, do you and Jeff know which one of you is the biological dad, or is that something that you don't actually know?
We didn't know until Ethan was born. We had to have a DNA test. For us, it didn't matter who was the biological father, but for legal reasons, we needed to know.
Do you think that that Ethan may ask that question, like, who's my real dad, sort of thing? Is that something you sort of have thought about as well, that conversation?
Certainly, and that's part of our storybook to Ethan. It shows, you know, that we both donated sperm to this process, and only one of the sperm that fertilised the egg actually resulted in him, and he'll know who that came from, and to be able to understand his biological mm-hmm. heritage. That's quite important, to understand his biological heritage, not for any grand reason, except that, you know, it's what it's part of a normal human curiosity to want to know that. But at the end of the day, we hope Ethan will grow up understanding that, you know, what Corey mentioned before, that it's love that makes a family, whether the child was born through surrogacy, whether the child was adopted, or their step parents involved, etc. It's all to do with, you know, making sure the child grows up loved and wanted.
We're talking with Rodney Cruz. He's from Gay Dads Australia. We'll be back in a moment.
Don't come knocking on my front door. Tell me.
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
We're talking with Rodney Cruz from Gay Dads Australia. There, Rodney.
Yes, I am.
Great. Now, a lot of people, I've heard even people laugh at the idea of a gay dad, and they just dismiss it out of hand. So can you just talk about that and what Gay Dads Australia is?
Right. Well, Gay Dads Australia is it's a social support and information network for gay men who either have children or are thinking of having children. And we have state groups in Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia. There's some active email discussion groups, and people meet for social occasions as well, with the kids, picnics, etc. We just don't have people who have done surrogacy. We have lots of surrogate members, but we also have people who have adopted. They're a very small number, actually, because adoption's not available in Australia. People who do foster care, co-parenting with lesbian or straight couples, people who have gay dads who have become fathers through known donors, and of course, I suppose the largest group of gay dads are those who have children from previous heterosexual relationships.
And then they've just moved on to a different stage of their life, basically.
Yes, yes.
And how large is your membership around Australia?
Oh, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but there are certainly several hundred members listed on our groups, the majority of them being in Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland. And probably, I'd say 50% of those are gay dads who have had children through previous heterosexual relationships.
So what sort of functions does Gay Dads Australia serve? Do you have sort of, you know, social get-togethers, or, you know, what is it more of an online support, sort of asking questions about, you know, people who may have been through the process, and, you know, how's it going to work? What sort of services do you offer to your members?
Look, it's a bit of all of that. I mean, it's really designed as social support and information. We don't do any lobbying or on behalf of Gay Dads Australia. We're not an incorporated group. We were set up primarily to offer support for gay men who were fathers or wanted to be fathers. So people get together often initially online and exchange stories, ask questions. How do we do this? How do I deal with this issue? Maybe something to do with dealing with their ex-partner or dealing with Centrelink or something like that. But we also have information sessions where groups, particularly the New South Wales groups, organise monthly get-togethers where they have a dinner and a speaker, and people come along to become informed, ask questions, and also meet other gay dads in similar situations. So it's a great social arrangement for gay dads to meet each other.
And if any of our listeners want to check out the organisation, do you have a website or a phone number? What's the best way that they get in touch?
The website's at www.gaydadsaustralia.com. And if people just go to that website, and there's information there on all the various parenting options and how to get in contact with all the state groups.
Fantastic. Now, Rodney, I'm just wondering, in your own case, obviously surrogacy laws in Australia are still, being formed and being revised. How did it work with you guys? If you went to America and used an American surrogate mother, and how are you and Jeff recognised currently under the current Australian laws, and will the proposed law reforms affect you in any way? Are you both legally parents at this stage?
Well, unfortunately, I'd like to say it's an easy answer, straightforward answer, but it isn't. In the US, the laws are very clear on surrogacy, and we would be considered both the legal parents in the US. However, because we're Australian, when we came back to Australia, only one of us was considered the legal parent, and that was the biological father. The other dad wasn't, and so the only way we have to get some semblance of parenting rights and responsibilities is to get a parenting order from the family court. That's the only thing we've got at the moment. The new legislation that's been talked about, which Corey talked about earlier, is designed or aimed at surrogacy arrangements that occur in Australia. So even though that would give both fathers, in this case in Australia, parenting rights, it doesn't appear at this stage that it will affect fathers like myself and Jeff who did surrogacy overseas. So we'll still miss out under the proposed surrogacy reforms. However, having said that, the recent changes to federal legislation in regard to how parents, same-sex parents are treated under federal law, and particularly with regard to the family court, does cover us in a de facto sense.
What is it that, even under the well, certainly currently and even under the new laws, what legal status will you lack compared to heterosexual parents? Will the non-biological father, you know, not have certain rights around you know, say, with medical services? What sort of issues would there be?
Without getting a parenting order from the family court, the non-biological father technically can't consent to medical treatment for the child, can't enrol the child in school, can't pick the child up from childcare, a whole range of matters that are associated with, you know, what people would think is a day-to-day activities with their own children. So yes, you know, technically they're prevented from doing those things.
But you actually have this parenting order, and that bypasses those problems or deals with them. And
a parenting order is not the same as full parental status, but it does grant the non-biological father certain parenting rights. So they can make decisions on medical matters. They mm-hmm. can enrol the child at childcare, etc. So it overrides, but it runs out at age 18. So the order is not quite the same. It's a second class form of protection for the child.
Right. And did you have to undergo expense to obtain that order? Did you have to pay for sort of legal fees and all of that stuff to go?
Yeah, there is. Any time you have to go to a court, it's never cheap. It doesn't matter how people say you can do it yourself, etc. It's never cheap. There's always quite a bit of expense involved. But yes, there are expenses involved in filing these applications and preparing them, of course.
What happens if the biological father dies?
In the case of where a parenting order has been granted, the non-biological father would have to present back at the court and have the order probably revisited, but it's, you know, it is highly likely that the court would just hold that the child would be raised by the non-biological father.
So the non-biological father could, in effect, adopt the child?
Probably in the ACT, Tasmania and Western Australia, yes. In the other states at the moment, no.
So what would happen potentially if that couldn't happen, that adoption?
We'd have to rely on parenting orders, and
right.
And the family court have quite a bit of experience in this. There are many, many couples, particularly surrogate dads, who have presented at the family court for these orders, and so they're aware of the situation. There is no the different situation, I suppose, to a typical family court matter is there's no competing interest. There's no third party, if you like, or disaffected spouse who's contesting custody, if you like. So it's a fairly straightforward matter.
I mean, I guess that raises another issue, which we probably should have discussed with Corey, but do you know of cases where there actually is a competing interest, where the surrogate mother, I guess, you know, changes her mind and then sort of fights for custody of her child? Is that a common scenario?
No, it's not actually. We often say it's like a tally movie of the week scenario. There has been two situations that we know of, and they were both in the US, and they were both about 25 years ago, and they were both in situations where the surrogacy system over there was in its infancy, and people weren't screened correctly for whether they were suitable to be surrogates. It's, But the reality is when you meet a surrogate for the first time, their biggest fear is what happens if I carry this child for the intended parents and then they don't want it? And the biggest fear for the intended parents is, what if she carries a child for us and then won't give it to us? So it's quite the opposite. And the reality is that, you know, women who choose to be surrogates are doing it for the right reasons. And they generally don't have a biological connection to the child. So it's you know, they're wanting to ensure that that child goes into a happy family.
We're talking with Rodney Cruz. He's from Gay Dads Australia. We'll be back in a moment. Rodney Cruz from Gay Dads Australia. Now, look, what about the public perception of this? How have you guys coped with that, or has there been any hostility towards you?
Well, a lot of people often start with the preconception that there would be some hostility or people being very uncomfortable with it. But the reality has been extremely different. Even before Ethan was born, when people started finding out that we were going to have a child through surrogacy, the reaction we got was incredibly positive. And once Ethan was born, and you know, again, the reaction from family, friends, work colleagues, and complete strangers was quite amazing. We had complete strangers stop us in the street and you know, ask us questions, and they were very, very supportive. I think the perception that the community is hostile to this in general is actually not true. I think there is small sections of the community that are very uncomfortable with gay parents, but I think the majority aren't. And I think the reason is, whether it's two dads, two mums, one father, one mum, whatever the arrangement is, as long as the community, the people in the community, see that the child's loved and supported and wanted, that's what ultimately matters, not how the family is constructed.
I imagine you live in a city area. Where are you based?
I'm based down in Melbourne, and I live in the inner city.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think that maybe in, you know, country areas where, you know, climate can be a bit more conservative? Do you think that you might have had a bit of a different time?
My partner Jeff and I spend a lot of time up in rural Victoria in a place called Numurkah, which is just outside Shepparton, a small town of about 4,000 people, and it's, you know, it's farming community around there. And you would think that it would be a redneck,
yeah.
But it's quite the opposite. I mean, country folk are very straightforward. They, you know, they don't mince their words.
They speak their mind,
and. We haven't found any hostility at all. In fact, we find a lot of excitement. A lot of people have questions. They're all very curious about the process and how our daily lives run. But we haven't had any hostility at all. And I know that may surprise some people, but, I mean, it hasn't occurred even in accessing services like childcare or Centrelink or anything like that.
I think Australia is a much more tolerant country than a lot of people would like to think.
I agree.
Or that talkback radio makes it out to be.
Okay, well, let's have a little bit of basic intolerance here. To a lot of heterosexual men, just to throw a bit of sand in the works here, to a lot of heterosexual men, the sight of two men kissing and cuddling is actually quite offensive. We find it unpleasant. Have you found in your relationship with your little boy, say, coming in and jumping on the bed, in the morning, I mean, do you think there's any kind of stigma or anything that's going to happen in his head? I mean, if he grows up to be a heterosexual boy, he may find that scenarios with his two daddies kissing or holding hands or being intimate in any way, he might find them distasteful. Have you thought about that?
Oh, certainly. But I think people are merely just reflecting the way that they've been brought up themselves, and so if people are brought up to believe that two men or two women being affectionate with each other,
I think two women is a different category. I think there's actually a lot of heterosexual men actually find that quite a turn on to see two women being sexual. You know, so I don't think that corresponds. I'm thinking specifically with men here.
If children are brought up with the view that it's somehow wrong or inverted commas, unnatural, then yes, there's a chance that the child will adopt those views. But children who are brought up in families where those are not issues, and acceptance of people's diversity is part of their upbringing, generally don't have those views. And, the reality is those who have problems with it tend to make the most noise. They don't tend to be in the majority. Maybe some of the older generation who were brought up with those values still hang on to them, but certainly not the younger generation. And you know, I wouldn't even put myself in the young generation, but the Gen Ys of our time, the 20-somethings, they don't have a problem with it at all. It's just not an issue.
We've only got a couple more minutes left, Rodney. I just wanted to bring up the issue of extended family. How does that work in your case? Does Kelly, the surrogate mother, is her parents and aunts and uncles, all of them involved? Do you have one great big extended family, or is it sort of limited to you and Jeff and your families? How does that all work?
No, I mean, one of the real benefits of having a child through surrogacy is that you do get this amazing extended family, and Kelly, her husband, and their three children, and their parents, and their families are all part of our extended family. And we've been back to visit them a couple of times, and it's been great. I mean, we've been incorporated into their families as well, and The issue about surrogacy becomes very secondary. It's just about love and friendship and the things that bond people together.
Do you support commercial surrogacy in Australia?
Look, I think it's a very complex question, and of course I use commercial surrogacy in the US. I think that surrogacy arrangements need to be such that the women who choose to be surrogates are not financially disadvantaged by it. There needs to be an adequate compensation for their time, their loss of income, any expenses that come with it. So I think I would say I'm in favour of commercial surrogacy if it's regulated carefully, but I think Australia's a long way off that.
And how strong is this desire in men and gay men to have children? Is it a sort of inbuilt wiring that people want to have children? Can we expect there to be many, many more thousands of examples like yourself?
Oh, definitely. And I think the answer is it's the wiring that makes men want to have children is irrelevant of whether they're gay or straight. It's obviously much easier for straight men to have children than it is for gay men. But the desires and the wants and needs for gay men are there. And it's just because, technology, artificial reproductive technology and surrogacy has become more available to gay men that they're now being able to explore that option of becoming parents. And yes, are we going to see thousands more? Absolutely. I mean, we know, just in regard to surrogacy, we know that there are dozens and dozens overseas in the US, Canada, India, at the moment who are going through the surrogacy process to have children. And there are hundreds already back here who have done it. And it's just going to grow.
Right. And you expect that will be completely socially accepted? It will just become a part of the Australian family landscape?
I think it already is, to be honest. I don't think... I honestly have a lot of faith in the Australian community as a whole because they... they really do look at a family and they look to see whether there's love, there's support, and whether the children are wanted. That, they're the fundamental things that everybody wants to see in a family. Nobody looks at a family and says, well, I wonder if they're the biological mother or the biological father in a straight family. They just look to see whether there's love and support.
We've got to close on that note. We've been talking with Rodney Cruz from Gay Dads Australia, and we would also like to thank Corey Erlam from the Coalition for Equality for a fascinating show looking at gay dads and surrogacy. We'll be back next week.
And of course you can listen to this show on our website, dadsontheair.net. It should be up by later this afternoon. We'll be back next week.